online sort of media. Mind you, a lot of the PTI has a great deal of support in the diaspora, that sort of played up this notion that maybe a Trump administration would coax the Pakistani military into getting Imran out of power. So there's a lot of parallels. They're not the same thing. They can't be reduced to the same thing, but I do think that it tells us a lot about how the liberal center continues to fail and pave the way for these so-called outsiders to thrive.
Asim Sajjad Akhtar, we thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Political Economy at KD Azam University in Islamabad. That does it for our show. Tune in Thursday, Thanksgiving, for a special broadcast with Indigenous scholar Nick Estes and Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Message. And on Friday, we'll speak to Namante Nenkimo, an Indigenous leader from the Amazon in Ecuador, as well as Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha from Gaza. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Berkerney Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nodura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy holidays.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you.
Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the St. Helens High School principal faces criminal charges in covering up a child abuse scandal that rocked the Oregon community.
The Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians celebrate regaining rights to fishing and hunting.
And in international news, Israel and Lebanon reach a ceasefire.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 27th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eliza Yerkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. On the same day the St. Helens School District appointed its interim superintendent, Principal Katie Wagner was criminally charged for misconduct regarding the recently uncovered sex abuse cases under her watch. A grand jury approved 6 charges against her yesterday after hearing testimony from school officials and police. She turned herself in this morning to the Columbia County Sheriff's Office. She is currently lodged at the Columbia County Jail. She faces 2 counts of first-degree criminal mistreatment, 2 counts of first-degree official misconduct, and 2 counts of second-degree official misconduct. During her administration, 3 teachers allegedly sexually abused numerous students over multiple years, Kyle Robluski, Eric Stearns, and Mark Collins. The Department of Human Services said it's investigating both Wagner and former Superintendent Scott Stockwell for failing to report the ongoing abuse. DHS is also looking into 4 teachers, including Stearns and Collins, who were recently arrested.
The Confederated Tribes of the Siletz Indians have been federally recognized for almost 50 years. Last month, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has given the tribes a greater role in regulating hunting and fishing. In the 1850s, the federal government murdered and forced tribes onto reservations as a part of a genocidal plan to claim land and resources. The government confederated or combined the tribes together as a single people, despite their different backgrounds and languages. The Siletz is a confederation of over 2 dozen bands and tribes whose traditional homelands spanned across Oregon. In 1855, the government forced them onto a 1.1 million acre reservation on the Oregon coast. In the 1950s and 60s, Congress enacted a policy known as, quote, termination, that stole land from tribes and revoked their federal recognition, stripping them of funding and services. The Menominee tribe in Wisconsin was the first tribe to regain recognition in 1973. The Silets became the second in 1977. To regain a fraction of the land they had in 1855, they had to agree to restrict their hunting, fishing, and gathering rights. The federal and Oregon governments recognized this agreement was culturally oppressive and wrong this year. In a joint statement, attorneys for the U.S., Oregon, and Silets wrote, quote, "The governor of Oregon and Oregon's congressional representatives have since acknowledged that the 1980 agreement and consent decree were a product of their times and represented a biased and distorted position on tribal sovereignty, tribal traditions, and the Silets tribe's ability and authority to manage and sustain wildlife populations traditionally used for tribal ceremonial and subsistence purposes," end quote. The tribe celebrated the restoration of rights at their monthly powwow. Silets chairman Dolores Pigsley said, quote, "There's a lot of youth out there that are learning tribal ways and culture. It's important today because we are trying to raise healthy families, meaning we need to get back to our natural foods," end quote.
A ceasefire deal between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah went into effect today. The ceasefire, brokered by the U.S. and France, runs for 60 days but could be extended. More than a year of bombing and other military action has left more than 3,700 Lebanese, mostly civilians, dead, while over 130 people have been killed on the Israeli side. Under the ceasefire, Israeli troops will leave Lebanon and Hezbollah militants will move north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops and United Nations peacekeepers will be deployed in the area between the river and the Israeli border. The agreement is not expected to have any effect on Israel's ongoing war against Hamas and Gaza.
The Texas state government is offering Trump's administration land to build large camps to hold people awaiting deportation. State Land Commissioner Don Buckingham said, quote, "We have 13 million acres around the state, and if there's something that meets the federal government's needs, we want them to be able to utilize that," end quote. She recently offered Trump a 1,400-acre ranch in Starr County, where Texas is currently constructing a border wall. Newly appointed border czar Tom Homan visited Texas and the border yesterday. He said, quote, "Let me be clear. There is going to be a mass deportation because we just finished a mass illegal immigration crisis on the border," end quote. This past weekend, Homan announced that any state or municipality that takes action to oppose the Trump administration's mass deportation plan would lose federal funding as a result. He said, quote, "If you have a governor who says, I'm not going to cooperate, I'm going to block you, well then, federal funds should be slashed to that state, and I mean hugely so," end quote.
The Biden administration announced it awarded $8.5 billion in grants to Intel back in March of this year. Earlier this week, the administration rolled back the CHIPS grant by $500 million. This decision comes as the chip manufacturer continues to struggle financially, finishing the largest round of layoffs the company has ever seen. And they recently announced a $17 billion loss during the past financial quarter. The reduction of the federal funding is due in part to Intel missing certain deadlines, like improving its technological capacity to rev up domestic chip manufacturing. Intel is unique among chip producers in that it designs and manufactures chips in the U.S., while other companies outsource their manufacturing. The reduction in funding is also due to Intel receiving a separate $3 billion investment to develop technology used in the Pentagon's defense and weapons systems. The CHIPS and Science Act was signed into law by President Biden last year, awarding around $280 billion towards domestic semiconductor manufacturing and research. The federal government is hurrying to distribute those funds before the Trump administration takes over in January. The Intel campus in Hillsborough will get $1.8 billion of that money to help upgrade part of its facilities.
Amelia Earhart disappeared over the Pacific Ocean in the summer of 1937, attempting to become the first female to circumnavigate the world. The mystery of her and her plane's disappearance endures because no trace of her body, the plane's wreckage, or her navigator, Fred Noonan, have ever been recovered. A South Carolina-based company called Deep Sea Vision announced earlier this year that they had sonar images of what might be her plane, the Lockheed Electra, off the Howland Island coast. That was where she and Noonan were supposed to meet to refuel. However, the photograph was debunked as just a plane-shaped rock. Many theories have tried to explain her disappearance, including that the plane ran out of fuel and sank to the bottom of the ocean. Others believe that she and Noonan survived the crash but were taken prisoner by Japanese forces in the build-up to World War II. Another theory is that they survived the crash but died as castaways on a nearby island, Niku Maroro. Deep Sea Vision CEO Tony Romeo has not given up on the search. He told NPR, quote, "Talk about the cruelest formation ever created by nature. It's almost like somebody did set those rocks out in this nice little pattern of her plane just to mess with somebody out there looking for her," end quote. In a recent Instagram post, the company announced the search is still on as they continue to cover almost 7,700 square miles.
Israel and Hezbollah agree to a ceasefire in Lebanon. The Trump-Vance transition team finally signs ethics agreements. And a political expert talks about possibilities for the lame duck session of Congress. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Under the deal reached today, effective at 4 a.m. tomorrow local time, the fighting across the Lebanese-Israeli border will end. This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities.
President Joe Biden is announcing Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to a ceasefire, ending one conflict in the region. Israel will withdraw, and in theory, Hezbollah has agreed to no longer strike across the border. The Lebanese army will take more control from the Iran-backed militia, and Hezbollah's infrastructure in South Lebanon will not be rebuilt. More than 3,000 people have died in the conflict that grew out of the war in Gaza. The ceasefire resembles previous failed agreements, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says its future will depend on what happens in Lebanon. Israel's security cabinet approved it 10-1, with far-right Minister Ben-Gvir voting no. As lame duck presidents tend to do, Biden may use his last weeks to take bold actions on foreign policies. Plus, the divided Congress leaves most domestic issues in legislative gridlock. Professor Jordan Cash with Michigan State University says approving long-range missiles for Ukraine's war against Russia is the kind of move Biden can take on his own.
He's trying to find some way to push Ukraine and Russia to a certain endpoint in the war, perhaps to get a final foreign policy victory to vindicate his administration at the end.
He adds Biden is probably trying to get ahead of how President-elect Donald Trump will approach the conflict. Trump has promised to end the war in days, but Ukraine supporters fear his affection for Russia's Vladimir Putin. President-elect's team has finally signed the necessary standard ethics agreements to let cabinet nominees start detailed work with their agencies, but some unconventional picks, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., are still drawing scrutiny and even skepticism. Chris Noble is with Health Access California.
RFK Jr. will continue to propagate medical conspiracies that further erode trust in evidence-based medicine that will result in preventable death and grave threats to public health if given a seat of power.
The Supreme Court is being asked to review Parents Protecting Our Children versus Eau Claire Area School District. The case could decide if parents can sue a school if they feel a district policy infringes on their right to make children's healthcare decisions. Haley Archer with the ACLU of Wisconsin says the case's complexity is part of why it's so hotly debated.
We're balancing the rights of parents, we're balancing the rights of schools, we're balancing the rights of students, and ultimately, the safety of the student is, in my opinion, the most important of these rights.
Lower courts dismissed the case, ruling the groups didn't have standing since none of the group's families were directly impacted, but the case's return relates to culture war debates over gender in schools. With millions of Americans preparing for Thanksgiving, the political divide could strain family gatherings. If the conversation does skid into partisan turf, psychotherapist Emma Nadler advises taking a long pause before things get heated.
Anyone can say and do things they regret, and it takes at least 20 minutes of non-activating conversation to get back to your baseline regulation. So it's not 2 minutes.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program. by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on World AIDS Day and the Street Root's latest edition, The Vendor Issue. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, it's PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Tonight's weather will be cold and cloudy with a low of 36 degrees. And tomorrow, it will be cold and foggy in the morning, with the sun peeking through in the afternoon, a high of 44 degrees. Today in history, exactly 100 years ago, was the very first Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. 3 years later, the famous giant balloons made their debut. The quote of the day is from Dr. Lila June Johnston, a descendant of Dene, Cheyenne, and European ancestors, who is an author, researcher, and musician. She says, quote, "The polycrisis and the convergence of crises in the collapse that we are learning about and experiencing, that crisis happened a long time ago. Actually, it's manifesting now, but this crisis has been going on since 1492.
The U.S. Forest Service is using funding to turn potential wildfire brush into firewood for indigenous families. And Rhonda McBride looks at the word for thank you in three different Alaskan Native languages. With those stories and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Forest Service is spending another $20 million to remove flammable underbrush and logs from forests. Some of the funding will be used to turn that chopped timber into firewood for indigenous families to heat their homes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
The National Forest Foundation's Wood for Life project is similar to a food bank, but instead of food, it delivers firewood to tribal families at no cost. The nonprofit is receiving $250,000 to remove logs from forests in Idaho, Colorado, and Wyoming. That will produce firewood for half a dozen tribes: Shoshone Bannock, Shoshone Paiute, Eastern Shoshone, Northern Arapaho, Ute Mountain Ute, and Navajo Nation. Rosanna Jumbo Fitch is the Navajo Nation Chinle chapter president. She says thousands of families in her community receive wood through the project.
It's a huge benefit because it's used for warming the home, cooking, and everyday needs. And our biggest population that we serve is our elderly population, those that are 65 and older.
Nationwide, in counties with a high percentage of tribes, roughly one-third of households rely on firewood to heat their homes. That's according to Census Bureau data. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Long before there was a designated day to give thanks, there was a time when expressing gratitude was a form of deep spirituality. KNBA's Rhonda McBride looks at the word for thank you in three different Alaska Native languages, starting with Yupik or Yuktun.
Guyana.
For Asikayakayak, Guyana is a word with deeper layers of meaning. Asi grew up near Bethel in Shafornik, where, as a small child, he absorbed the true meaning of Guyana.
As I got older, I was able to help my father more, and I watched him butcher seals at my brother's hut, and he would say, "Kita, give these to these elders."
As Asi carried the seal meat to his elders, he remembers how full his hands were.
I gently used my feet to knock on their door, and they would open up, and then they would, "Azai. Oh my, thank you so much."
Goodness, cheese.
Hune Lance Twitchell has dedicated his life to spreading knowledge about the languages and cultures of Southeast Alaska, where he teaches Tlingit.
Some of our elders, like the late Kingisti David Kancik, used to talk about the power of this phrase and how much emphasis and love you could put into it, sometimes by dragging out that last syllable, goodness, cheese.
It isn't just a casual thank you. It's Masi Cho.
Kay Wallace is Gwichin, a traditional healer who believes Masi Cho carries great spiritual energy, that gratitude helps to heal from sickness and trauma, and also survive hard times.
When I talk about my elders, most of them have passed, but they all remember hunger. They remember the starvation period. And then when somebody would just share a bone with them, a moose bone, caribou bone, or a piece of fish. Masi cho.
Wallace says most of us today have never known such hardship and the importance of sharing what little you may have to give.
Masi cho. You're keeping me alive. You're keeping my family alive. Thank you.
She says Masi Cho comes from a time when gratitude was a way of life. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
Indigenous researchers have released a new survey of Native American youth that touches on preferred terms, cultural identity, and more. With details on the story, it's Suzanne Potter.
A new survey of Native American teens and young adults highlights a growing preference for the term Indigenous rather than being referred to as American Indian. Researchers from the Aspen Institute's Center for Native American Youth surveyed close to 1,000 Native Americans under age 24, including a large contingent from California. The center's Cheyenne Runzabove says the term Native American is still dominant.
53% of Native youth prefer the word Native American, and only 7% prefer the word American Indian. We continue to see that 7% going down. And what we continue to see uptick is the word Indigenous.
The report, called Center Us, also found that many Native youth are apathetic towards U.S. elections and disappointed in the rate of change. It also found that Native youth who feel culturally educated are 4 times more likely to see themselves as capable of making a difference than those who do not. Runzabove says culture is identity for Native youth and points out that more than 60% of California Native youth said they feel either moderately, a lot, or a great deal culturally educated.
Language, history, stories, connection to land, all of those things are at the core of identity for Native youth, and so we have to be mindful of their true cultural identities.
The survey notes big differences between young people in urban areas versus small towns and reservations when it comes to the availability of culturally informed health care, after-school programs, and money for college. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering adding monarch butterflies to the endangered species list. This comes amid a long population decline stemming from a slew of man-made factors. But there are ways people could help monarch populations thrive. Edwin J. Vieira joins us again.
Monarch butterflies could be on the federal endangered species list by year's end. Eastern monarchs found in New York and other northeastern states saw an 80% population decline between the 1980s and 2020. Their western counterparts have seen a 90% population drop. Environmental groups petitioned for them to be listed as threatened back in 2014, and the monarch became a candidate species in 2020. Rebecca Quinones-Pignon with the National Wildlife Federation says monarch butterflies face many threats.
Well, the main threats that we have identified for the monarch butterfly are habitat loss and fragmentation of the remaining habitats. Climate change is at the top of the list, definitely, and the excessive use of pesticides.
She calls monarch butterflies a canary in the coal mine for pollinators in the ecosystem, a warning that more needs to be done to help the environment. A dozen species of bumblebees are also candidates under the Endangered Species Act. They also fall victim to the same threats of monarch butterflies. Home gardeners can play a role in helping monarch butterfly populations by planting milkweed and goldenrods, which are helpful to the species. Milkweeds are the only plant monarch butterfly caterpillars can eat and survive on. Mary Phillips, also with the National Wildlife Federation, says there are some mistakes people make in trying to help monarchs thrive.
Don't worry if, you know, you see the various predators. There's also a milkweed bug that sometimes goes on these plants. People get nervous about that. It's okay. It's natural. It'll go away. It will not harm the milkweed overall.
She adds another common mistake is spraying garden or systemic pesticides, which can harm monarchs. Some states are taking action to end the use of certain pesticides harmful to bees, butterflies, and other pollinators. New York passed a law banning some use of neonicotinoids because of their harmful impacts on pollinators and other species. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
A new initiative, Healthy Farms, Healthy Bays, aims to bridge the divide between upstream farmers and downstream aquaculture. They aim to find collaborative solutions to protect the state's ecosystem. Trimmel Gomes has more on the story in Florida.
For decades, Florida's upstream farmers and downstream aquaculturists have been at odds over water quality and environmental impacts. Now the new initiative, Healthy Farms, Healthy Bays seeks to bridge this divide and foster more collaboration to protect Florida's fragile ecosystem. It's released a new report that outlines its visions as well as specific steps to protect water quality and conserve Florida's working lands. Initiative co-chair Randall Dasher, a Suwannee County farmer, played a key role in uniting these groups to work on creating a healthier watershed.
It is about coming together and collaborating, getting across the table from each other in a non-threatening way, because too much of that has gone on, you know, and that just makes people be less likely to listen and hear and talk about best practices.
The partnership, supported by the Florida Climate Smart Agriculture Work Group and a $100,000 grant from the Volo Foundation, brings together farmers, aquaculturists, and environmental experts to tackle challenges like nutrient runoff, declining water quality, and the impacts of climate change. President of the nonprofit Solutions from the Land, Ernie Shea, says the initiative marks a turning point in how Florida's agriculture and aquaculture can work together when it comes to climate change.
We're all affected. Climate change takes no prisoners. It affects all sizes of operations. And what we've done with Florida Climate Smart Agriculture is bring together the entire value chain, the producers right up through the associations that represent farmers.
The Suwannee River Basin was chosen as the focal point for their efforts. A team of farmers, aquaculturists, and university experts conducted a two-year analysis to identify the most pressing challenges and propose solutions. One key recommendation is accelerating best practices to reduce nutrient runoff, from planting cover crops to using microbial sprays and reducing chemical inputs that affect water quality. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
A spike in syphilis cases in recent years has impacted tribal communities at about 10 times the national scale. Rates are highest in South Dakota, where some tribal health leaders have been advocating for a federal public health emergency. Kathleen Shannon has more on the story.
South Dakota leads the nation in a surge of syphilis cases in recent years. According to reporting from KFF Health News, tribal health leaders, whose communities are disproportionately impacted, have called for federal agencies to declare an emergency to no avail. South Dakota Department of Health data show about 650 documented cases of syphilis in the state so far this year. 476 of those were among Native American people, or 73% of cases in a group that makes up just 9% of the population. Megan Curry O'Connell with the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation says the epidemic started about the same time COVID did, when public health departments were already stressed, but federal resources could still help.
Generally, just increasing the staff and resources available to have boots on the ground for people to go do contact tracing, to talk to people who have syphilis, make sure they get treated, treat their sexual partners. That is what you need to contain an outbreak.
O'Connell says penicillin is a commonly used cure for syphilis, which often goes undiagnosed because symptoms of the sexually transmitted infection look different from other STIs. They may be limited to feeling under the weather or having a rash. The outbreak has disproportionately hurt Native Americans in the Great Plains and Southwest. According to the Great Plains Tribal Epidemiology Center, syphilis rates among Native Americans in its region soared by nearly 2,000% from 2020 to 2022, more than 10 times the increase seen nationally. O'Connell says a big danger is that an infected pregnant person can pass syphilis to her baby.
It can cause stillbirth. It can cause death shortly after birth. It can also cause a host of other medical issues. They can be lifelong. So what we're very concerned about is the impact on babies.
Recent data show the rate of increase in syphilis cases is slowing, but O'Connell says it's not time to give up yet. This story was produced with original reporting from Jasmine Orozco Rodriguez for KFF Health News. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Greater Dakota News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says, "Don't worry, Trump always fails."
Trump is a bully. Trump is a narcissist. His only loyalty is to himself, not the Republican Party, Elon Musk, the January 6th hooligans, least of all those who voted for him. Trump doesn't follow orders. He hasn't had to, till now. He is inconsistent. Maybe he doesn't remember what he said before. He does not care to understand. Much of what Trump says is meaningless, including his threats. The only facts he cares about are his desires of the moment. We have nothing to fear but our own fear. Trump can't override logistics, physics, the resistance of worker bees. So what if he's in the White House? Maybe he is the straw to bring down the already fragile Jenga of democracy. Maybe he's just another president who realizes he has to do what big money tells him. I am thankful that Donnie is as flawed a being as he is. I am thankful that he has almost no power over my life and the people I interact with. I hope I am still thankful a year from now. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Chris Gao, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Kathleen Shannon, Edwin J. Vieira, Freda Ross, Brian Bull, Suzanne Potter, and Tramell Gomes. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.